You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. The following is a message from Zingerman's. From June 30th to July 3rd, 2011, come hang out at Camp Bacon, a four-day festival hosted by Zingerman's. The main event is an all-day affair at Zingerman's Roadhouse featuring plenty of bacon, bacon learning, and such luminaries as Alan Benton, John T. Edge, Molly Stevens, and more. The event will be taking place in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Proceeds from this event benefit Southern Foodways Alliance. Also, on Friday, July 1st, there'll be a special benefit performance featuring Andre Williams and the Gold Stars and special guest John Langford and Skull Orchard. Visit www.zingermanscampbacon.com for more information and for tickets. Once again, that's www.zingermanscampbacon.com.
Welcome to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Erica Wides, your host. And I feel like I sort of have to, I think a lot of people feel this way, people who are involved in food or care about their food, that we have to kind of navigate this very complex, complicated web with our food, with making choices about, you know, every purchase, every bite. You know, it's like so loaded. Everything is loaded, every choice. Having to think it through every time I cook or I shop or I want to eat something or I want to eat out. It's like this constant battle, if I'm raging inside of myself, between wanting really high quality food that's really flavorful, especially produce, fruits and vegetables, and wanting to support organic farms and sustainably raised stuff, but also wanting to keep it thrifty and not blowing the bank. And my income has taken sort of a steady decline over the past few years. Like, you know, it peaked in 2007, and then every year since it's gone down pretty steadily, which I'm starting to get a little worried about. So I'm trying to be a little more careful with my money. And, you know, because of that, I have to be careful about what I buy. And so I'm always a sucker for a good deal, of course, especially good deals on produce and especially fruit, because I love fruit. I've talked about fruit a lot on the show and I love buying it, but, you know, it can be kind of expensive. And while buying everything organic is the ideal choice and what I want, it's often not that realistic. And the non-organic stuff is, you know, much less appealing. But, you know, it's like, it's the question, is it better to at least be eating the produce, even if it is just a tiny bit poisonous? Or is it better to not eat it at all and avoid ingesting the poisons? Who knows? I still don't know. So are the health benefits of eating it enough to override or cancel out the risk of ingesting all the toxic stuff that's dumped on conventional produce or not? I mean, the opinions out there are still mixed. Some people say buy organic only. Some people say the health benefits you get from eating produce are enough to cancel that out. I don't know. I still want my fruit. And, of course, it's berry season now. It's hot. It's summer. God, is it hot. I went to check on my bees today, and they were all hanging out on the front porch because it was really hot. The hive has, like, a little front porch. And when you know it's hot when all the bees are sitting out on the front porch fanning themselves, drinking, like, little glasses of bee iced tea. You know it's hot. And hot weather means berry season. Although the strawberries, I think, are gone. I was at the farmer's market yesterday. I didn't see any strawberries. But it's definitely blueberry season. Now, the Environmental Working Group, whose website I check in with regularly, just published their list of the Dirty Dozen, which is the top 12 most pesticide residue-laden fruits and vegetables out there. And blueberries are number 10 on the Dirty Dozen. Basically, all thin-skinned stuff is on that list. All the berries, of course, peaches, apples, anything with a thin skin that has to soak up a lot of water to become juicy is on the list. I think I mentioned the list last week, too, because I was talking about these organic blueberries that I had bought in my local AMP, and they weren't so horrifically overpriced. I think I talked about that last week. And so, I mean, I would like to buy the organic all the time. I want those organic farmers to get their fair share. I want them to get what their products are worth, for sure. It's just, right now, it's hurting me a little economically, so I have to be careful. But anyway, it's this toss-up whether I, you know, buy blueberries or not. Are they poisonous? Are they not poisonous? Should I get the organic? Should I not? Can I resist a good deal? Often the answer is no, I cannot. So today I was up in my local neighborhood greengrocer, up, I say up because it's up the block, it's uphill. And then they had these boxes of these like big fat New Jersey blueberries, you know, the local ones now that we get. And they were 2 pints for $3, which is an insanely good price. I mean, crazy cheap. That's probably the price they were when I was a little kid, $1 a box. So, you know, if you think about that, like if I had a farm and I were raising those berries and I had to harvest all those berries, I would like to get more than $1 a box wholesale, you know, which is maybe what they're getting. I mean, it's kind of disturbing how cheap that is. But nonetheless, it was a great price. So, of course, I had to buy them, you know. Bought 4 boxes, took them home. And, of course, you get what you pay for. Those blueberries stink. They were really big and plump, but they had no flavor. Not only did they not have any flavor, but they had anti-flavor. It's like the flavor was like in negative, like in reverse. Like they sucked the flavor out of themselves. They were all show. They're all like pumped up without any substance. They were like breast implants. That's what they reminded me of. They were like the Pam Anderson of blueberries. Like little round plump sacks filled with flavorless gel, basically. Very disappointing. Now, these were the, you know, Jersey berries made by someone in New Jersey, but marketed by Driscoll, which should have tipped me off because I find that Driscoll generally, you know, markets berries that don't taste like anything. And in comparison, I was out on the street last week, and there are these street fruit vendor guys all around New York, and their stuff is funny because it's like buying seconds. You know, it's like the stuff that isn't perfect looking goes to those street guys, but then they put it on their carts and it sits out in the sun all day. And I think it actually ripens and gets better. So last week I went by one of these fruit guys and he had 2 pints of blueberries for $4. And I thought, oh, that's a really good price. So I bought some of those and I took them home and I opened them up. And they were kind of crappy looking, like they were kind of beat up and shrivelly and they had a lot of stems. But they actually tasted really good because I think sitting out there in the heat all day, they ripened up a little bit more. I mean, they weren't profoundly delicious, but they had a good mix, a little sweet acid mix. They were, you know, that's what you're looking for in fruit, a little balance of sweetness and acid. That's all we want. They were kind of homely looking, these berries. They weren't the Pam Anderson berries. They were sort of homely on the outside, but quality inside berries. They were like the quiet berry that reads in the library at lunch instead of going to the cafeteria. You know who I mean? Like instead of sitting on the football player's knee in the cafeteria, she chooses to go and sit in the library and better herself. She knows that inside she's a quality piece of fruit. She just doesn't have it on the outside. That's okay. But even these berries, which were good, are nothing like the wild blueberry. I've been thinking about wild blueberries a lot lately because, well, I saw some growing locally upstate. But years ago, when I was a young cook, I was a sous chef, and I spent 4 summers working in Maine in a hotel. And I've been thinking about Maine a lot lately because I always think about Maine in summer, especially when it's so freaking hot here. And when I worked in Maine, I had one day off a week, and I would often go hiking on my day off, and I'd go up into the White Mountains, and I'd go hiking. And the mountains there, excuse me, are covered in wild blueberry bushes. Now, wild blueberry bushes are totally different than the cultivated, gigantic, pumped up Jersey berries. They're tiny, but they have a lot more flavor. They're really intense. Now, they're so tiny that you have to pick a ton of them just to get any sort of volume, but they grow like crazy up there. And so I'd go out hiking and I'd bring like a little bag or a little pail with me and, you know, pick as many as I could. I'd mostly just eat them. And I find these same wild berries now because we sometimes hike on the Appalachian Trail in what county is that? Whatever's north of Westchester County. Can't think of it. Where Tiny Bungalow is. So we hike up there on the AT sometimes, and those same blueberries grow along there. And the flavor of a wild blueberry is totally different. It's sort of a spicier, more intense flavor. They don't have the juice. They're not pumped full of water. They're almost like a dehydrated berry kind of flavor. It's more focused, less juicy. The flavor of a cultivated berry to me sometimes tastes like the flavor of artificial blueberry flavoring, like too much blue and not enough berry. Sort of like when you buy a cheap blueberry muffin and there's those little blue flavor dots that aren't actually blueberry. Sometimes those are little bits of dried apple that are dyed blue and flavored. Did you know that? Yeah, pretty disgusting. Anyway, we're going to take a very quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about blueberries because it's that time of year. We'll be right back.
Looks just like the sun. Looks just like you. Looks just like the sun. Looks just like it. But it looks just like the sun. Looks just like you. But I'm breathing, thinking wrong. Heart is pounding in his chest. Reaches suddenly for his gun. Ship is sailing.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show is sponsored by Camp Bacon. I didn't get to go to Camp Bacon. I went to Performing and Creative Arts Camp. We didn't make any bacon there. Anyway, welcome back to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Erica Wides, your host. So I was talking about blueberries, about the, of course, the disappointment. I'm always talking about disappointment with food, aren't I? It's always so disappointing. But also the joy of my time spent in Maine when I used to go pick wild blueberries when I would hike on my one day off a week when I was working in Maine. And it reminded me that I had learned as a child, and I went to Wikipedia to confirm this, about how the Native Americans used to pick wild blueberries. Wild blueberries are one of the three native berry species in North America. Did you know that? Jack, did you guys know that? Native? No? Your mic's not on. It's okay.
It's a collective no.
Collective no. Carlos nor Jack knew that. Okay, well, now you learned something. Three native berry species to North America. The cranberry, the blueberry, and I don't know the third. Anyway, the Native Americans used to pick these wild blueberries and other native berries. Oh, the chokeberry is the other one. I don't know really what that is. But anyway, they would dehydrate them, and then they'd make pemmican out of them. Did you learn about pemmican? We learned about pemmican in school. Pemmican was this food that they used to make. It was a one-to-one ratio of dried, pounded, powdered, lean game meat mixed with fat, marrow fat usually, often from bison or bear or moose, and then also mixed with dried blueberries or dried cherries. Yeah, pemmican. So it was a highly nutritious mixture that they used to make, and it was portable because it would be fully dehydrated and fully preserved, and then they would carry it with them when they went off on long hunting and gathering journeys. Just, you know, put it in your little leather pouch and strap it to your waist. So the Native Americans made it for thousands and thousands of years, and then it caught on with the early Europeans who came as trappers in the fur trade, especially up in Canada. And then later on with the Arctic and Antarctic explorers, too, because they were on the move, especially the trappers. You had to keep moving. And they didn't have time to stop and forage and hunt for food. So you could take this pemmican with you, and it would last indefinitely. So it was really kind of the proto power bar. It was like the original power bar of their day. And I would say probably the first Native American processed food product. The first one. It was a meal on the run, but without nutraceuticals and voodoo ingredients added to it. It was just meat, fat, and berries. The breakfast of champions, I think. No blueberry flavor dots, no whey protein, no corn syrup, nothing. Just fat, meat, and berries, which you can basically live on You could live a very, very long time on that. You might say, oh, but you're not getting any green vegetables. It's true, but you're getting omega-3s from the animals who grazed on grass. See, if you made it from bison, you got all your major food groups in there. You could live on it. So I'm thinking, like, maybe it's time for a pemmican revival. Like, maybe we should bring it back. It could be like this totally hip, locavore, sustainable, foodie, wet dream kind of bar. Even like the paleo diet people would love it. You know about those guys, the paleo diet people? They eat like raw meat and pebbles and sticks. They like it too. And so would the raw food fanatics. Those freaks also would love it. Because the meat wasn't cooked. It was just dried in the sun until it was really brittle and then pounded out into it like dust and then made into these bars, like, you know, sort of how you make jerky. So I actually found a company in Missouri that makes and sells pemmican. Yep. And of course, there are a million recipes online for it. This company in Missouri is called U.S. Wellness Foods. So I'm thinking about contacting them and maybe getting some just to try it. They make theirs with cherries because apparently cherries have a natural preservative in them. It must be the acidity. But I know that dried cherries are good in baking for sort of longevity in baked products. So I'm not surprised. But I think I'm going to contact them and order some. Maybe. I don't know. Maybe I'll just make some. I'm going hiking in Arizona next week. Not next week. In 2 weeks. So maybe I'll bring along some pemmican and go on like a survivor kind of thing and see what happens. We'll see. Anyway, so many years ago, before I was working in the food industry, I was a poor art student living in the East Village. This was in the 80s. And I lived in the East Village because it was really cheap back then. Hard to believe. I lived in a one-bedroom apartment that I shared. No, two-bedroom apartment that I shared with someone, and it was $650 for the whole apartment. It was a total dump, and it was on the sixth floor of a walk-up with no air conditioning, and it was kind of disgusting, but it was cheap. And anyway, back then, I existed mainly on pasta and bagels, which I think I talked about a few weeks ago about how when I was a vegetarian, how unhealthy I was. But I was very poor. And so when I would go out to eat with friends, which I did often because I lived on the sixth floor and didn't want to carry groceries up there, all those stairs. So I would go out to eat, but I would always order whatever was really cheap on the menu because I was living on $40 a week. That was for everything. That included, of course, all the supplies I needed for school because I was a photography major, and that was in the pre-digital days, and we had to buy ancient forms of technology like film and photographic paper, things that barely exist now. We had to buy them. So I was living on $40 a week, so it didn't allow for a lot of food splurging, you know, but I may do. So anyway, one day I went out for dinner with a friend and her friend, who I didn't know. And they both had jobs that allowed them like a little bit of spare cash. My one friend was from Denmark and she was here as a dancer. And if you're from Denmark and you want to go to New York as a dancer, the Danish government gives you money to do that. Yeah. But anyway, so we went to a restaurant and of course I ordered, you know, whatever was cheapest and semi-vegetarian. But the friend of the friend ordered a special and it was some... It was like a chicken special. So this chicken special was just a grilled chicken breast. But it was served with a blueberry salsa. Blueberry salsa. Now, yes, it was the 80s. And the 80s was the decade of grilled chicken and fruity salsas. Fruity salsas were hot. Grilled chicken was big. It spilled over well into the 90s, too. It was the era of fat phobia. So everything was grilled and fruity and light and, you know, that kind of stuff. Now, I had never, ever experienced berries being put in salsa before. And I thought it was like the most brilliant thing I had ever tasted. I tried it and I couldn't believe that like some utter genius had thought of this, that they, oh my God, you could put blueberries into a salsa and put it on grilled chicken. Genius. Little did I know, of course, that this was basically like the trickle-down effect of California cuisine that had started evolving in the 70s and 80s and was nothing revolutionary, and they were basically just copying something that had started somewhere else. But what did I know? I was, you know, a bumpkin from Long Island. I didn't really know anything about food at the time, and I was totally in awe of this idea that you could put fruit, something sweet, into something like a salsa, which was savory. I didn't even know there was any type of salsa other than the red kind that came in the old El Paso jar with the taco making kit. Okay, what did I know? Although my Eastern European mother, all throughout my childhood, had made various meat dishes with fruit in them. Like she would put prunes and apricots into things, and she put like raisins in her stuffed cabbage. I never really made the connection. This was like totally different, something completely different. This was raw. It was berries. It was a whole other thing. And it really stuck. Like it kind of stuck with me, and it gave me one of those little light bulb moments that made me start thinking about food a little bit differently. And probably was one of the moments that's got me thinking like, huh, maybe there's like a, maybe there's something going on here. Maybe there's like a career path I could follow or something like that. But anyway, of course, blueberries are great with poultry. And, you know, fruit is great with poultry in general. And, of course, I didn't know that at the time either. I was living on bagels. But it's great with poultry. It's also great with pork. And, of course, it's especially good with duck. I mean, when you think about duck, it's often served with fruity sauces. The acid in the fruit cuts through the fattiness and the richness of the duck. That's why duck à l'orange is such a French classic. The acidity and sweetness of the duck, I mean, of the orange, balances out the duck. It makes perfect sense. So back in Maine, working in Maine in the 90s, we had duck on the menu one night a week. It was a weekly menu that rotated. It still is. And Wednesday night was duck night. And when I first got there, my first summer, we, of course, had some sort of orangey thing on the duck. And then I think we changed it like to cherries a couple of years later. And then finally I was like, we're in Maine. What's going on? This is Maine. We're surrounded by blueberries. Why aren't we doing blueberries with our duck? And everyone said, ooh, that's a great idea. So I think I came up with like a spiced blueberry gastrique for the duck. So a gastrique is when you combine sugar and vinegar and cook it down and you make like a syrup, but it's kind of like an acidic syrup. It's sort of like the liquidy stuff in chutney. That's a gastrique. And I was trying to remember how I did it. But I'm sure what I did was I took a whole lot of frozen wild Maine blueberries because we used to get cases of them for making our pies. And I'm sure I cooked that down with, you know, a lot of honey and vinegar or sugar and vinegar. I think I may have even gotten blueberry vinegar, which was a very 90s thing to use. So I'm sure we had it. Cooked that all down for a really long time, then pureed it and then strained it, you know, or something like that. And this was, you know, a good change up from the orange duck that had been going on and then the cherry duck, you know, because we were in Maine. I said, why don't we put blueberries in something other than our pies and our pancakes? So we did. It was a big hit. And actually, I was wondering today if it's still on the menu. And I coincidentally even spoke with the owner of the hotel today on the phone because we're still friends. And she needs a line cook. I should have asked her about the duck with the blueberries if it's still on the menu. But incidentally, she does need a line cook. So if anybody is a nice, good, fast, experienced line cook who wants to spend the next two summers in Maine, you should contact me. You can tweet me or email me or something. If you want a job in Maine, let me know. It's a good job. It's a beautiful place. Pays pretty well. You're only there until the end of August. But thinking back on that duck entree, too, I was thinking that it might have made more sense if I had used dried blueberries in the gastrique. Because the whole idea with the gastrique is you're making a syrup, you know, a reduction of vinegar and sugar. So you don't really want to add any extra water to that. So dried blueberries would have made a lot more sense. And I can't remember, of course, if that's how I did it, because I don't remember anything anymore. But I may have notes somewhere. So those lousy blueberries that I bought today, I now have 3.5 pints of them left, and they really suck. So I was thinking about what I was going to do with them. And I think what I'll do this weekend is I'll cook them. I'll turn them into a cobbler, or maybe I'll make like a barbecue sauce or a glaze or something like that. You know, they suck on their own, and they mostly suck because they're full of water. They get pumped full and full and full of water, which makes them nice and big and fat, but that dilutes the flavor. So when you have subpar fruit like that, that's sort of a good way to salvage it, is you can cook it down and cook out the water and concentrate the flavors. You know, you sort of salvage the berry and the blue. You get the sweetness and the acidity from that. So I think I'll be doing that this weekend. It'll be kind of patriotic. You know, they're red. I don't know. I mean, they're blue. They're not red. I'll cook them with something red or, you know, Maybe I'll make a pie. I don't know. I'll do something 4th of July-y with them this weekend. But anyway, we're running out of time, so I just want to fill you in on a couple of things that are coming up. Like I said, I'm going to Northern Arizona right after the July 4th holiday. So I'm going hiking in the Flagstaff area. And I've been, you know, looking online for restaurant recommendations, looking on Chowhound, things like that. But if anybody knows of any great place to eat, you know, to get really good Southwestern cuisine or Mexican or whatever, Native American, let me know. You know, you can always find me on Twitter at Chef Smarty Pants. And you can also find the show on Facebook. You can look for Why We Cook on Facebook. And you can always listen to any of our shows on iTunes and on heritageradionetwork.com. I got to always get that in because sometimes I forget to mention it. But anyway, I'm going to Arizona. So let me know if you have any recommendations or, you know, any amazing hikes I should take or anything like that. I'm going with an 11-year-old. So she's pretty sporty, you know, but keep that in mind. Anyway, then I'll be back in town for like 2 days. And then I head out to Ohio to the Chef's Garden for the annual Food and Wine Festival fundraiser for Veggie U, which I have talked about here many times. And Beej and I have been getting our menu item ready. And we are psyched because this is the best dish we've ever done. And we are going to win the competition this year. So if you're in the Midwest, if you're in the Cleveland area on July 17th, I think, get some tickets, come, say hi. It's for a really good cause. It's going to be amazing. Great food. There's really great chefs coming this year. And then I come back to New York for a week. And then I'm participating this year in Meatopia. Beej and I, together, teaming up, we're going to represent Creekstone Farms Natural Beef this year at Meatopia, which is a big meat fest, which is usually on Governor's Island, but this year it's at Brooklyn Bridge Park, the new park, right at the bottom of Atlantic Avenue, which should be pretty great. And we've planned out our dish for that, too, using Creekstone Farms natural beef. And it's going to be an amazing dish. So if you're a big meat eater, get your tickets. Come on down to Meatopia. So needless to say, I'm going to be away for a few weeks. I won't be airing new shows, but we will play some of the best of Why We Cook. And then stay tuned, because when I get back, I know I keep threatening that I'm making changes, but those changes really are going to happen.
Shh.
What?
It's a secret.
It's a secret? No, I've already talked about it. That was Jack, the voice of God. But don't worry, faithful listeners. It'll still be the same show that you know and love, just better. Nothing's going to change that much. So we're just about out of time. So thank you to Jack and Carlos in the control tower. As always, remember that this show broadcasts live from behind Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And you can find us on iTunes at any time.
One more thing to add.
Oh, yes.
The Denmark government also pays for their electronic musicians to travel to the States.
See, Scandinavia, yeah. They've got it all. That place rocks. Yeah. Oh, well, I was born in the wrong country. All right, thanks. Good night.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. This week, all over the internet and also in all of the meat trade papers, as well as in this particular article on digital trends, a story has been running about the poop burger. Japanese scientists have found a way to create artificial meat from sewage containing human waste. Mitsuyuki Ikeda, a researcher from the Okayama Laboratory, has developed steaks based on proteins from human excrement. Tokyo Sewage approached the scientists because of an overabundance of sewage mud. They asked him to explore the possible uses of the sewage, and Ikeda found that the mud contained a great deal of protein because of all the bacteria. The researchers then extracted those proteins, combined them with a reaction enhancer, and put it in an exploder, which created the artificial steak. The meat is 63% proteins, 25% carbohydrates, 3% lipids, and 9% minerals. The researchers color the quote-unquote meat red with food coloring and enhance the flavor with soy proteins. Initial tests have suggested people say that it even tastes like beef. This has been Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer.
HeritageRadioNetwork.com has its own architecture show dedicated to the built environment, hosted by Curtis B. Wayne. Check out a small clip of Burning Down the House.
So if we look at tall buildings and we talk about the wind blowing over them, we have all these different variants on, is it a horizontal rotor, like the big wind turbines that you see off of Aarhus in Denmark, I think it's where it is, and the local people are very proud of it, or Falmouth, where the locals are not happy at all. Out west, there are enormous wind farms, but they're far from habitations, and so the low-frequency sound that's generated by those turbines is not a problem. But what we don't want in terms of taking this notion, this notion of the future and making it beautiful and bright and clean and silent, is to create...
Want to hear more? Well, tune in live to Burning Down the House every Sunday at 4:30 p.m., or check out past episodes in our archive, or subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. Thanks for listening.